Summer with memories that'll last a lifetime. Spots are filling up fast, so register now at assescamps.ca.
You are listening to CFRC Radio from Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca.
G'day and welcome to a Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is CJ the DJ and I am your host for this week's a Grad Chat. Of course, a show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs as well as CFRC. So thank you very much to both of them. Now, if you may miss the show at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify and CFRC Podcast. So no excuse not to hear what our awesome students and postdoctoral fellows are doing. Today, though, I'd like to introduce you to Zoe Brissot-Savarsis, who is doing a Master's in Astroparticle Physics under the supervision of Dr. Nahi Park. Welcome to Grad Chat, Zoe.
Thank you so much, CJ. Thank you for having me.
That's really good. And it's interesting because one of the reasons I wanted Zoe to come onto the show is because this Thursday is going to be International Women's Day. And so I wanted to highlight today and over the next few weeks some of our amazing female researchers and how they're helping change how we look at things in the world. So thanks for putting your hand up to do that today for us, Zoe.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for reaching out to all of us and asking for this.
Well, I mean, you had the first hand up. It was awesome. I go, yes, it worked. So we went like that. So with that, I guess we should get on. So your area is high energy neutrinos from extreme blazars. I'm assuming I'm saying that right.
Blazars. I think there's sometimes a distinction between blazar like you would wear and a blazar, which we call the star.
The star, prototyping ice cube Gen 2 module. So it's a pretty long one. However, I guess you have to expect that when you think about space because there's billions of years.
It's a big place.
It is a big place. Billions of space and billions of years in between. And so a little bit about that. I mean, there's a lot of things here that you talk about in your synopsis, you know, black holes, the South Pole, this place called Ice Cube, neutrinos. And the reason I know this word neutrinos now is because of Dr. McDonald.
Exactly, yeah. We're a little famous for it.
Yes, we are. So, you know, but I thought that was up at the Sudbury.
It is, yeah, absolutely.
Whereas you're looking at the South Pole.
We are.
Down in the South Pole. So explain a little bit about, you know, what do you mean by these high energy neutrinos or even how you got into this path look and what you're actually trying to accomplish?
So the thing that Ice Cube and the Sudbury Neutrino Observatory have in common is that they are buried deep, deep, deep underground. Mm-hmm. And we do that because neutrinos can pass through lots of stuff. You could have a neutrino pass through a light year of lead and it would just keep going. Or you know, maybe have like a 50% probability of stopping. So these particles are incredibly unreactive. And so
unreactive mean they don't get pushed aside anywhere. They just
stream just through you without stopping. So for instance, if I held my thumbnail out right now, pointing towards the sun, there would be about 86 billion neutrinos passing through my thumbnail every second.
A bit scary, isn't it?
But none of them react. You would be lucky if a single neutrino reacted anywhere in your entire body in your entire life.
Which is why we don't feel it.
Yeah, absolutely. They're just passing through all of the atoms in your body. So they're so unreactive. So the way that we get around that is we say, well, what if we have a really big block of space, like just lots of volume for them to interact with? And then every once in a while, if we have the numbers game right, every once in a while, one of them will come and ping and one of them will interact.
Right, right.
And then the reason that we put them deep underground is so that everything else gets blocked. All of the other particles can't pass through kilometers of ice. They will interact. They'll scatter before they get down there.
Which makes sense.
So it's a great background removal tool to put things deep underground, same as the Sudbury Neutrino Observatory.
But it's not easy to, I mean, I know with Sudbury, that was an old mine, which they've converted.
Yeah.
What was down in the South Pole?
So, it's just ice. It is kilometers of ice. And what we've done is we've drilled these boreholes like 2.5 kilometers deep using these high pressure hot water drills.
Right.
And then we've lowered these detectors down. They're kind of just like cameras that are very sensitive to single photons. So they're kind of like a string of pearls, and you lower them down and you do lots of them. You do a huge array. It's a kilometer cubed volume.
Okay.
That we're looking at.
But there are lots of drill holes.
Yeah. So we lower these little cameras down that are all in a string, and then we fill it back up with water and we freeze them into the ice. And then we've just got this great big area that has little dots, sporadic, just little cameras every once in a while.
Right.
And what happens is the neutrinos come and they've got this high, high energy. And when they finally interact with the ice, they let off this type of light.
All right. So you're looking for the light, which is hard to, because speed of light and all that sort of thing is not easy to detect. But I'm sorry, I know I keep going back to the Sudbury. That, when you see the pictures, it's a big cave and this big globe thing in it. But you're saying you're not actually underground with them per se. The cameras are, but you are all on the surface and you're interacting with those cameras somehow with technology.
Absolutely. That's a good distinction. So with Sudbury, they can actually travel down to their detector.
Mm-hmm.
But with Ice Cube, we put these cameras in the ice. They're done. We can never access them again. They've just got power cables and data cables feeding back to the surface.
If they don't work, then you cactus, as we say.
Yeah.
On that particular one.
You're done. Yeah, absolutely. It's a really fascinating procedure. I got to kind of monitor the experiment a couple of times and see, you know, which cameras are working and which ones aren't working. And I shouldn't be saying camera. They're called digital optical modules or DOMs. But I find camera is a little bit easier to think.
Yeah, for people like me.
People in general.
So you're working more with the Ice Cube then, with what you're looking for?
Yeah, I only work with Ice Cube. That is my collaboration that I work with.
Okay. So then, I mean, you're looking for these neutrinos, but what else? I mean, clearly they're pinging every now and then, but so what?
So what's incredible about neutrinos that other particles don't have in common is that they can pass through anything without really interacting. If you look at other particles in the universe, if we've got, you know, like cosmic rays, if we've got photons, if we've got, you know, other normal things, they bounce around quite a bit and they lose information as they travel to us. But the very cool thing about neutrinos is that they're just carrying all of the information from their source in a little bag and just bringing it straight to us and dumping it at our doorstep.
Right.
So we can learn so much from looking at neutrinos because they're still carrying their source information so well.
And what kind of source information?
So for instance, I am looking at blazars.
Right.
Which is a type of black hole.
Okay. You got a black hole where everything sinks in.
Yeah. As far as we know, at the center of most galaxies, we call them AGN or active galactic nuclei. And there's just these supermassive black holes at the center of galaxies. And every once in a while, they've got these jets that are pointing out the top and bottom of them. So, you know, you've got this disk and it's ripping up all of this matter. And every once in a while, there's just stuff shooting out the top of the bottom, really, really energetic. And every once in a great while, those jets are pointed straight at the Earth.
Okay, right.
And that's what we call a blazar.
Okay.
That's when we have this little pointy jet straight at us that says like, woo!
And that's very different to what comes behind like a meteor or anything like that.
Absolutely, but great question. So it's so incredibly energetic, these jets. They're one of the most energetic things in the universe. The speeds that things are ramped up to are unimaginable. They are really, really huge fractions of the speed of light. And so there's very, very energetic stuff happening. But what we aren't sure about is whether or not these jets have neutrinos coming out of them. And it's not the neutrinos themselves, per se, that we're super interested in, but the neutrinos would be a result of other particle interactions.
Okay, yep.
And so if we can see the neutrinos, that means that there has to be other guys. There has to be like protons. There has to be what we call hadrons.
Okay.
So it's kind of like a smoking gun. Like if we can see this, then we know that this other thing is happening.
But wouldn't you see some of those other things as part of this blazar? Because you said it's spewing out all stuff.
Absolutely.
And neutrinos is the hardest one to find.
Absolutely.
But the other stuff must be easier to analyze.
Very good point. But that stuff interacts on its way to us. It bounces.
So as you said, then you lose bits.
Exactly.
Bits go off.
Exactly, exactly. Especially charged particles, because there's huge magnetic fields all around the universe and all kinds of different structures. So especially charged particles are just getting bounced all around. And so most of them don't even get here. Or if they do get here, we don't know where they came from.
Right. Or they've been diluted.
Yeah, absolutely.
They don't have the same power.
And even the light that's getting to us, we know that it's been filtered. It's interacted with stuff on its way here.
So it's not pure.
Yeah, yeah. So we can kind of extrapolate what it used to look like, but we don't have that pure information like we do with neutrinos.
Neutrinos aside, sorry, I'm fascinated by the fact that these blazars have come out of these black holes, because I always thought black holes is like a sink.
Absolutely.
So But you're saying these blazars, these are coming, spewing out, which is opposite to what you expect.
So I think we have to kind of zoom out a little bit. The black hole is at the very center of the active galactic nuclei. Mm-hmm. And a black hole is, you know, this really compact thing. And it's got something often called an accretion disk that is floating around it. So it's kind of like a plate or a ballerina skirt when they're spinning really, really fast.
Right, yeah.
And so all of that stuff stays outside of the black hole, because most everything passes the event horizon of a black hole is never coming back out.
Right, right. So this is the outer boundary that so far could go in or out.
Exactly, exactly. Okay. So that is what is making up these jets. There's nothing that is, I misspoke when I say coming out of the black hole. It's coming out of this blazar, this active galactic nucleus. The black hole is a part of it, but it's also got this accretion disk. Sometimes it's got this thing called a dusty torus, if there's other ones. And then this jet is kind of ripping stuff out of this accretion disk. So it's all happening outside of the black hole, but the black hole is the engine for it.
It's the engine, okay. So back to your neutrinos then. First of all, as you said, it's a long way. It's got to travel for us to pick it up. And well, first of all, the blazar has to be pointing towards us. Secondly, even though other things along the way are getting shoved left, right, and center or disintegrating or whatever, these neutrinos are still going. But the ice cube is in one part of the world.
Mm-hmm.
How are these random neutrinos finding its way to ice cube for you to be able to monitor it?
So you can think of these jets as kind of widening a little bit. You know, it's coming from something that's already probably pretty big, but you can even think of it as a point. And then, you know, it's just like a little cone that comes towards us.
Right.
And so the Earth is getting bathed with neutrinos from all places at all times. And, you know, most of them are not blazars. Most of them are, you know, stars and the diffuse neutrino background. There's just so many of them coming from all these different places. So when we get a signal and we kind of try to trace it back to where it came from, we can't really say with any positivity, yes, this definitely came from this blazar, or yes, this definitely came from this Seyfert galaxy or any of the other guys, because you don't really work in absolutes in physics.
Even though neutrinos go through everything,
yeah,
you'd think it would have a straight line to somewhere.
So even if that line is straight, and even if we trace that line back and it points straight back to something that we know is a blazar, we will never say, hey, that is absolutely 100% positive. We're always going to say like, hey, we have, you know, like this 95% confidence interval that this is of astrophysical origin. And, you know, it's a huge statistics game that I never really considered before.
Did you like stats?
No. Crazy about it, but it turns out it's my whole field. So having to learn the heck out of it.
I wasn't that great with stats myself. So you talk about, I'm going back to your topic, the research topic, high energy neutrinos. Okay, we've figured out what they are. from blazars, extreme blazars. Yeah, we've figured out what they are.
Jetty boys.
Yeah, and where they come from. Prototyping Ice Cube Gen 2 module.
So that's a whole thing.
Oh, it's totally different.
Yeah, so I've got two main projects going on, or probably more than two going on now, because I'm going to extend into my PhD here.
Yay.
But the other thing that I'm doing is I'm trying to build a prototype for the expansion of the experiment. So hopefully, if we get the funding for it, we're going to make the experiment much bigger, which is going to make it way more sensitive. We're going to be able to measure many, many more things if we can get this experiment to be larger. And the prototype that I'm trying to build is pretty cool because it won't be very costly. And hopefully, you know, if it actually works, it will be able to see more wavelengths of light than the current ones can see.
Right. So whenever I'm thinking about finding a piece of equipment that can analyze, you can have big machines and you have small machines. Clearly, you've got something there. And is it tweaking the algorithm, or is it more to it than that?
So there's really two main things that are going on. Well, I mean, there's lots of things, but there's two main things that are going on with the data taking for Ice Cube, or with, you know, data analysis with the whole flow. So there's the things that are actually in the ice. There's you know, the tech itself, which are usually pretty small and self-contained. You know, you can probably pick one up in your hands. Okay. The one that I'm building should be very small and very light and very simple.
Ah, so you can take it to other places.
Yeah. But then once the data is transferred to the surface, there's a whole other ball game of things that need to happen. There's a lot of machine learning that happens.
Right.
To try to interpret these signals, because, you know, there's just all these cameras that are just constantly flashing. It's so much data.
Mm-hmm. And what does it mean? What does each flash mean?
Exactly. And so you're trying to find a track, you know, so that if all of these cameras are constantly flashing, you're trying to figure out, okay, but what was the actual source? You know, which of these flashes are actually from a neutrino signal? Which ones of these are noise?
Oh, yeah. So even under even underground, you're still going to get some noise, as you call it, coming through.
Because you do get other signals that aren't what you're looking for. And then you also just like nothing is perfect. The DOMs, the optical modules.
They must be generating.
Absolutely.
Noise.
Absolutely.
Themselves.
So you need huge algorithms. And
to cut those bits out. If you're hearing this, don't worry. But if you're hearing this, let's look at it more closely.
Yeah. So there's a lot of really incredible machine learning and other tools that are going into creating these data sets that we can actually use.
So with the data sets and everything like that, and you're finding these neutrinos, and you said you're wanting to see where the source for the neutrino came from and what else is in there. What are you finding? Are you finding anything other than it sparks this light?
So I couldn't tell you yet. You know, there's lots of different analytical tools that I'm using to try to figure out, you know, do I have a signal from one of them? You know, what if I stack the signals from all of them and kind of layer them on top of each other and see if that's statistically significant? But even if I do get something that's statistically significant, I can't write a paper and say, I have done it.
Yes.
There's neutrinos from blazars. I can write a paper that says like, hey, so I have, you know, 95% confidence that this, I have, you know, some 68% confidence that this is happening. This is my region that things might be coming from.
And with what you're doing, can that be used for other scenarios?
So, yeah. So what I'm doing is tiny, teeny, tiny slice of what Ice Cube is doing.
Right.
You know, we've got hundreds of members and, you know, most people are not doing anything related to what I'm doing.
Right.
There's, you know, there's people that are working on neutrino oscillations. There's people that are actually, I can't even list the things that people are working on, because literally hundreds of people.
Right. But do you ever chat with each other? Because, you know, sometimes, because you're working just one very, very small part, you might need to know what the other things are going on, because that could have an impact on your thinking.
Absolutely. The left hand should know what the right hand is doing.
So do you do a lot of that, a lot of collaboration in terms of this is where I'm up to, what are you up to?
Absolutely. We have two collaboration meetings per year. We have one in the spring, one in the fall. And, you know, we've also got our Slack channel, and you make connections with people so easily because you're both so fascinated with the same things. And,
right.
And everyone gives a talk about, you know, what they're doing and their research is. And, you know, you go through the schedule and you say, oh, that looks interesting. That looks interesting. That looks. And then you show up to these talks and then you have dinner with the person and you say, oh, you're also doing wavelength shifting materials. Can we talk about that? How did you source this? What were your results?
Yeah. And, you know, if I told you this, would that change your mind?
Yeah, absolutely.
Kind of thing. That, I actually think some of those things is what's the most fascinating, because this is why I like doing this, you know, doing grad chat, because I get to hear about different work. And from one day to another, I'll have someone in this section of pathology doing a little protein and one cancer, and another one in pathology doing a different protein in the same cancer, and never the twain shall meet. But it's still fascinating to see, you know, this is just a tiny, tiny little bit, and yeah. Neutrinos are even tinier, I'm sure, than any of those. So with these conversations and things that you have, and thinking about coming back into education, you've aligned yourself with very strong women in the field, in the various fields, one in your undergrad and then now again in your grad. Are you finding other women in your particular area, not necessarily specifically on the neutrino part, but in astrophysics itself, are you finding, and maybe you'll find more when you do your PhD, more women that you can reach out to? Not saying we should ignore what the men are saying, far from it.
But no, community is important and representation is important.
Yeah. Are you finding that at all, or are younger women coming through who are also have an interest in astroparticle physics?
So it's actually incredible how many women are in the astroparticle program now.
Great.
I am surrounded by women in my classes, in my working group. We are half women.
Fantastic.
But there is the leaky pipeline.
Ah. What do you mean by that?
So, you know, you go through your undergrad and there might be 50% women, and then you go through grad studies and there are going to be
drops off a bit.
More difficulties faced by gender minorities and racial minorities. And
right.
Then as you go on to grad studies, and then as you go to looking for postdocs and looking for positions, there's always going to be more challenges mm-hmm. for people mm-hmm. who are underrepresented.
Right.
And so by the time you get to, you know, faculty positions and permanent positions, that representation that was there in undergrad is no longer there.
Mm-hmm. Which is a shame, because, you know, we need lots of different ideas out there from different perspectives, different backgrounds. In general, we need that. So hopefully you'll keep going with that. So what's your end game for this research? Yeah. Is there one, or is it just a pure fascination and taking that next step to help whatever the next experiment could be?
Yeah, I
think. Because what are we hoping to find with these neutrinos? It's out there.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's nice.
Yeah. I mean, so.
What does it do for me? What does it do for us on the ground?
The really cool thing about what we call multi-messenger astrophysics is that we are looking at neutrinos. But we can also look at photons. We can also look at cosmic rays. You know, classically, we could only really look through telescopes to learn anything about space. But now that we've got, you know, gravitational waves and all of these other messengers, if we can put all of those messages together mm-hmm. and get the big picture of what's going on in the universe, then we get to solve problems so much more efficiently. So, you know, you could ask me the question of, you know, why study astrophysics? How is it important to humankind? How do we justify spending money on these things when we could be spending it on healthcare? And, you know, these questions are always there. Healthcare should have more
yes.
money going towards it.
Yes.
But so should science. We're not well funded either.
Yes.
And I think to answer that, you know, science answers these very fundamental questions. Apart from, you know, curiosity and our place in the universe, you know, learning more about the fabric of reality and mm-hmm. you know, the nature of particles, that's going to help in all fields.
Yes.
You know,
including health.
Yeah, and you know, including fabrication of materials. You know, do you want a smaller cell phone? Figure out how particles work good. Granted, astroparticle is probably not the most direct route there, but
we've always had this fascination with space. I mean, we've all looked up into the sky and wondered, you know, how far is that star? And are we alone? Which we'd be naive to think that we are the only living thing in the universe and beyond.
Very big place.
Yes.
I had a boss who would always ask me, well, what's the point of studying astrophysics? What's it going to do for me? And I was like, you know, like if you don't have any curiosity about the universe, that's not my problem.
No, and I do, so I'm going to go and do it. there's always a connection somehow, even if we don't always realize it, I think. Okay, so I know you've had these strong women. So Dr. Park, I mean, I know you kind of fell in your lap to a point that you got to work with Dr. Park, and clearly she's doing some great stuff. But what are some of the other things they're doing other than these experiments? What else is she trying to do there to help, for instance, more women get into a field that is not always perceived as something feminine?
Yeah. You know, I think just the fact of her existence is incredible because, you know, it's my story shows representation matters. I literally followed the women. You know, there were so few women, yes, and my entire life path has happened because that representation was there. But she's also kind of incredible in her commitment to diversity and equity and inclusion. Right. We have a community agreement that we go through twice a year and that we all read out loud together and that we all have the option of adding to or taking away from.
Okay.
Which is so nice to sit down together and really verbalize it on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. Hey, this is not okay. This is not okay. This is how you deal with that. This is who you go to if this happens. If you don't want to talk to me about it, this is who you talk to about it.
Right.
She's created such a good environment, which I don't think a lot of people do.
That's great.
And she's also included a lot of women in the group, which I love. I love having a group that is half women. I've never had that in my life.
Totally different perspectives on things.
Yeah. So it's really incredible to
be
around.
She seems extremely supportive.
She is. And she really is.
Which I think is really, really important. Not enough of that these days, of us supporting each other. And sometimes women can be the worst enemies, right?
Yeah, it's very
because
true.
Because sometimes I've been in environments where you think the women would be supporting you, but they're actually trying to knock you down for some reason. And they think, well, hang on a minute.
Yeah, like maybe it's subconscious. Maybe they've got their own stuff that they're
correct
not working through.
So it is, as you said, really nice when you get into an environment where that is not happening.
No, it's such a conscious decision that she's made to create and foster this environment.
That's great. Well, you've found the right one there then, haven't you?
Yeah, I'm going to do my PhD with her as well.
Oh, fantastic. See, that's always a nod, isn't it? When the student wants to continue into the next degree, into it. Well, Zoe, this has been fantastic. What a great way to start for International Women's Day. So I really do appreciate you coming on the show and giving us your insight into neutrinos and Ice Cube. And these blazars and black holes.
Thank you so much.
There was a lot
much.
Of different things there. Yeah.
Thank you so much for having me, CJ.
No worries at all. Thank you. If you want to see some pictures from Ice Cube, there is actually a public gallery at icecubewisc.edu/gallery. And you can sort of see some of the pictures that they're able to get from Ice Cube. So maybe you want to do that. Yes. I look through some of them. I go, okay. I need to ask more questions. So anyway, that's it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat sadly comes to an end. Don't forget, you can download the show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and CFRC Podcast. Just type in Grad Chat. Until next week, this is CJ the DJ signing off with a big hooray.
Garage rock, hip hop, folk, punk, and electropop. New, Canadian, and even local. Indie Wake Up handles your morning. Here for you, Kingston. Weekday mornings from 8 to 10. On the one, the only, CFRC 101.9 FM.
Since its inception in 2022, CFRC Power Plays has become the number one destination for all things Queens football.
And that is a touchdown for the Gales!
With over 50 million lifetime views, CFRC Power Plays is the defining voice in Queens football coverage.
Looking for Nico Cuomo! Cuomo! My goodness! Nico Cuomo with a touchdown!
Follow us today on Instagram at CFRC Power Plays, your number one spot for rock solid football action.
Today on Wings, Village Goddesses of India.
The divine in India is perceived as the ultimate truth. It is idolized in different forms, such as male and female, and also as semi-human, like that of Ganesha, the elephant god. But each one is treated as an individual power, and people all over the country pray to the divine power of their choice. Against this background, this radio program is about our goddesses and how extremely popular they are in the Hindu mind.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Hello, I'm Indu Ramesh from Bangalore, India. Today we are talking about goddesses in Hinduism. I have three friends with me, Vatsala Iyengar, broadcaster, translator, and writer. She has four books to her credit about legends, jewels, and sacred objects used in temples. I guess she is just the right person for this show. I also have Gayatri Balu, an attorney who has specialized in corporate law, keenly interested in theater, as well as both classical and folk music. And Aparna Devagiri, a human resources specialist with a multinational company, again deep into classical music and Hindu philosophy. Before we start the program, let me give you a brief introduction about Hindu deities. In India, goddesses are not ordinary women. Hundreds of them are worshipped in the country. Their images are extremely beautiful. 40 different types of diamond, ruby, emerald, and gold jewels, like the crown, the head jewels, dangling earrings, nose rings, bangles, wristlets, finger rings, waist belt, toe rings, and many more adorn them, making them shine very brightly. They are also dressed in dazzling silks and decorated with strings of flowers. Huge temples are built in their names all over India, and devotees visit these temples in large numbers almost every day to seek the grace of the goddess.
Mugi ge natu chanda, joktiya jadi chanda, kollana gulidali chanda, hennina maimyaga, naga yurige chanda, taiya jadi chanda, taiya jadi chanda.
Her nose ring is enchanting. Her long tresses, her symbol of marriage, her armlet adorning the body of a woman are beauteous. The mother's tresses are beauteous.
At the same time, these goddesses are very powerful. They ride a tiger or a lion and kill demons and devils fighting all alone. There are so many legends and tales about their independence and dominance over the male. What do you say, Gayatri?
In India, we have a goddess for agriculture, a goddess for epidemic diseases, a goddess for wealth, a goddess for protection of the city, a goddess for knowledge, and even a mighty goddess to kill evil forces. The list of her powers and her various forms is endless. Vatsala has done a lot of research on this topic. Let's hear what she has got to say.
You are right. Perhaps only in India do we come across such a female-oriented worship system.
What is the reason for the popularity of the goddesses in our male-dominated society?
To answer your question, we have to go back to the very beginning of Indian civilization. As you know, India is basically an agricultural country with over 70% of its population in rural areas. So, naturally, people gave great importance to fertility of the soil and strong sons to cultivate the land.
ಏಳು ತಲೆದ್ದು ಎದ್ದು ಯಾರ್ಯಾರ ನೆನೆಯಲಿ ಎಳ್ಳು ಜೀರಿಗೆ ಬೆಳೆಯೋಳ ಎಳ್ಳು ಜೀರಿಗೆ ಬೆಳೆಯೋಳ ಭೂತಾಯ ಎದ್ದೊಂದು ಗಳಿಗೆ ನೆನೆದ್ಯಾವು ಎದ್ದೊಂದು ಗಳಿಗೆ ನೆನೆದ್ಯಾವು
ಅಟ್ ದ ಬ್ರೇಕ್ ಆಫ್ ಡಾನ್ ದ ಸನ್ ಆಫ್ ದ ಸಾಯಿಲ್ ಪ್ರೇಸ್ ಟು ದ ಆಲ್ ಇಂಪಾರ್ಟೆಂಟ್ ಮದರ್ ಅರ್ತ್ who fills his field with the aroma of spices. Is there a better way to start his day? In the second stanza, this cultivator makes a votive offering to his family deity to help him grow maize.
Mooda muttaya muttaya noda badatana moodlalli ragi meleyudda moodlalli ragi meleyudda beledare ಮಾಡುವೆ ನಿನಗೆ ಹರಿ ಸೇವೆ ಮಾಡುವೆ ನಿನಗೆ ಹರಿ ಸೇವೆ ಮಾಡುವೆ ನಿನಗೆ ಹರಿ ಸೇವೆ
ಟು ಪ್ರೇ ಫಾರ್ ದೀಸ್ ಬ್ಲೆಸ್ಸಿಂಗ್ಸ್ ವಿಲೇಜ್ ಗಾಡಸಸ್ ವರ್ ಕ್ರಿಯೇಟೆಡ್ ಅಂಡ್ ವರ್ ವರ್ಶಿಪ್ಡ್ ಆಸ್ ಮದರ್ ಗಾಡಸ್ ಅಂಡರ್ ದ ಕಾಮನ್ ನೇಮ್ ಆಫ್ ದೇವಿ ಮಾತಾ ಅಂಡ್ ಅಮ್ಮ ದ ನೇಮ್ ಆಫ್ ದ ವಿಲೇಜ್ ವಾಸ್ ಆಲ್ಸೋ ಅಸೋಸಿಯೇಟೆಡ್ ವಿತ್ ದ ಗಾಡಸ್ ಟು ಎಸ್ಟಾಬ್ಲಿಷ್ ಹರ್ ಪವರ್ ಓವರ್ ದ ಏರಿಯಾ In fact, even Mumbai got its name because of Mumba Devi, its guardian goddess, and likewise Kolkata from Kali. Let me tell you about an interesting episode. In South India, in the state of Karnataka, by the beginning of the Christian era, food gatherers would place a few neem leaves in their basket with the belief that this would ensure a good collection of food. Neem, as you know, is antibacterial, antifungus vegetation. In a tropical country like India, neem leaves are considered to be helpful in curing diseases like pox, plague, etc. And it is believed that health-granting goddesses can ward off such epidemic diseases. Thus, there are goddesses who carry the name of Plague Amma, Pox Amma, etc. There is even an AIDS Amma for curing this disease. Such is the belief people have in the power of their mother. Always think of a goddess as someone beautiful, wearing silks and jewels, etc. But there are many exceptions.
That's true. Not all goddesses are good looking. In Bangalore rural district, a goddess suffers from defective vision. She cannot see anything nearby and has a long sight. So the nearby devotees do not receive any favor from her. On the other hand, people from distant places get her boons.
I will not be surprised if a devotee presents a pair of contact lenses or glasses to the goddess so that she can see even those who are nearby to bless them. To continue our story, about 200 years ago, plague hit a place called Sirsi in our state, and even the British officer's daughter suffered from this disease. Though a non-believer in Hindu tradition, this officer prayed to the goddess and his daughter was cured. As a further remedy, the wooden image of the goddess was transported from the village and left at the outskirts of another village. This place also did the same, and so did the next village until the image was finally immersed in the sea. This event is still carried out as a grand festival. In many places, there is no image of the goddess. She can just be a belly stone within the village. At times, she is only a head-shaped stone placed at the outskirts. On this stone, a mustache could be carved or painted to stress her manly powers. Or she could just be a tree. Her body is the village itself, and she has grown roots in its soil. This concept of a village goddess also has different meanings. For example, just as a child goes to his mother and complains about somebody who has not treated him properly, the villager goes to the temple and complains about somebody who has done him wrong. The mother naturally punishes the wrongdoer, as this story illustrates. Gayatri?
Here is the story. In a particular village of South India, anyone who has been cheated by another person takes a fowl to the shrine of the goddess. He kills the bird, dips his hand in its blood, and thinking of his enemy, smears the wall of the shrine with blood. Once he returns to the village, his enemy suffers from diarrhea, vomiting, fever, and convulsions. Repenting for his sin, the afflicted person offers worship to the goddess and thus ends the enmity. So, the village goddess is the judge to provide justice to the aggrieved person. This method of seeking justice in the presence of the goddess is a very common practice in the villages.
Just goes to show that protection of her people is foremost for her. I think even the concept of fertility of the soil and crops rising out of the earth is still very important to the concept of the village deities. This is a story my mother used to tell us when we were children and first about eating vegetables. Once upon a time, a drought occurred in central India and sages prayed to a forest goddess by name Banashankari for rains. Unable to bear their suffering, the goddess wept continuously for 9 nights and her tears filled up lakes and ponds, irrigating the land. She also produced vegetation out of her body and came to be called Shakambari. She is still worshipped in the month of October with 108 varieties of vegetables and fruits.
Fertility, the goddess is also capable of protecting against snake bites, scorpion bites, etc. In one temple, a scorpion appears on a particular day of the year, receives the food given by devotees, and slips away. The goddess is called Vrishikeshwari, Vrishika meaning the scorpion, and this tradition still continues. In many parts of India, a snake pit is also worshipped to pray for children.
Manasa is a North Indian snake goddess And a tale tells us that when a trader ignored the deity, all his 6 sons were bitten by a poisonous snake. It was only after he realized his mistake and prayed to Manasa did she restore the lives of his sons. In the earlier era, women who gave up their life for the welfare of the community were also worshipped.
There was once severe floods in a village, and a lady by name Channamma protected the entire area by holding both her hands as a barricade against the gushing waters. She lost her arms and died, but was immortalized as a goddess. Her image has no hands, and she is fondly called as the armless Amma.
There are many mythological stories about women who suffered injustice at the hands of males and became goddesses.
Mariamma of South India is an example where a young Brahmin girl is tricked into marriage by a lower caste man. She becomes very angry at this betrayal and kills herself. She punishes her husband by burning him into ashes and transforms herself into a goddess. At these temples, the husband is often shown as a male beast.
I have in fact witnessed a festival in a goddess temple where the male is symbolically humiliated and sent out of the village as punishment. This is really very interesting, as it helps us understand the fierce independence and dominance of a woman over her male consorts in traditional Hindu society in ancient times.
You mean to say that men are often cast in disruptive roles and the village goddess is equated with a civilized and just society?
It's true.
Do you think it is the result of matrilineal societies that existed in ancient India?
Yes. In ancient India, mother right was the basis of social system of the agricultural people. Agriculture was the discovery of the woman. She was the first cultivator of the soil, and her childbearing capability was similar to the vegetative power of the earth. The normal happenings of wind, rain, sunshine, even storms and eclipses could not be explained by the tribal people. They were explained as something from the heavens. The fact that the tree blooms with flowers and then fruits, which is used so happily by the community, must have given rise to the idea of nature as mother. Thus, the initial stages of this economy upheld the supremacy of the woman. The life-producing power of the mother became the central figure of tribal and rural religion. Mother Earth became the womb in which crops were sown. Female figures with a bulging womb and huge sexual organs were carved and were offered magical rites to increase fertility. Thus, primitive mother goddess cult was an important feature of our religion. This identification of earth with woman is universal and can be found in all ancient cultures and civilizations across the world. That is why the cult of the mother goddess has been a very important feature of our religion.
When we speak of the term mother for the goddess of India, we must bear in mind that this word suggests a mother's nurturing aspect rather than act of physical childbearing. Lakshmi is the mother of all, but she bore no children. Nor did Saraswati, the goddess of knowledge. Parvati, the consort of Shiva, is the mother of the elephant god Ganesha and Skanda, the warrior god. But she did not bear them in her womb. This is a very strange fact, as in Indian society, a bride is fully accepted only after she gives birth to a baby.
Another very funny thing is, in spite of being called as mother, the village goddess is a virgin and unmarried. Her untamed sexual energy is magically turned into a very powerful destruction of the demons who are men. Bursting with this energy, she is unrefined,
consumes country liquor and enjoys eating raw meat. So, animal and blood sacrifices are commonly offered to the goddess to please her. Talking about blood, the menstrual flow is believed to make the land fertile, and there is a very fascinating tale behind this. Shakti, the wife of Shiva, one of the major Hindu gods, dies. And unable to bear her death, Shiva roams about like a madman, carrying her dead body over his shoulders. To make him put it down, the other gods cut the body into pieces and make them fall at several places. Her female organ fell at one such place, and the fossilized stone is said to menstruate for 3 days in a year. Thousands of people visit this temple in the northeastern part of India to pray to the goddess on this occasion.
There's a strong relationship between a village goddess and trees. People believe that the goddess lives in these trees and hence do not cut them. Instead, they wrap a sari around the tree, apply turmeric and vermilion, and wave lamps at the tree. There is this story of a village chieftain near Bangalore who cut a banyan tree, not realizing that goddess of good fortune resides in it. He used the wood for household purposes and met a gory death. Trees and plants are also held very sacred in India, and many of them are worshipped as goddesses. Among them, the most popular plant all over India is the basil plant and is called Tulsi. Each traditional house has a small square earthen pot in the backyard where Tulsi is planted, and daily a lamp is lit in her favor.
This tradition has a lot of scientific explanations also.
Tula means one who is incomparable and true to the name. Tulsi leaves have a lot of medicinal value and have proved to be helpful in improving digestion, in curing ailments like gallbladder stones, jaundice, cough, cold, etc. Just one leaf of Tulsi a day can reduce the blood sugar level as well as cholesterol. It can improve the digestive system and can reduce fever.
No wonder today many popular brands of tea contain Tulsi leaves.
Tulsi is considered to be the beloved of Krishna and Vishnu, and a garland of Tulsi leaves is said to be the best floral offering to please the god.
Talking about trees and plants, I would like to tell our listeners about the plant forms of Durga. And foremost among them is banana, a very auspicious plant all over India. Raw banana is used in curries. Ripe ones are eaten as fruits. Its leaves are used as plates on all traditional occasions and marriages, and its bark is used for craft decorations. Turmeric is used as a basic seasoning in every type of Indian cooking. It too has many medicinal properties and is also used as a remedy for minor cuts and bruises. It is the plant form of Durga herself. The wood apple tree is considered to be very sacred, and a single leaf offered with devotion is equal to an elaborate offering. The fruit of the tree is very cooling and is useful in stomach ailments. The goddess of this tree is Shakti, that is, energy personified. Pomegranate fruit is described as the blood-colored teeth of the goddess. Ashoka is a very sacred tree in our country and is believed to increase fertility. A goddess called One Who Is Free From Sorrow lives in this tree. Harvested rice or paddy is a highly auspicious food grain and no feast or festival is complete without offering it to Lakshmi, called as Dhanya Lakshmi. We worship other traditional plants and trees as goddesses, as they make us feel good.
Trees as goddesses and gods have been well established in India. For example, the neem tree is female and the sacred banyan is male. In our country, villagers often face severe drought, and their way of pleasing the rain god is to celebrate the marriage of the neem and the banyan trees. They plant these saplings and conduct a regular marriage just as they would do for their children. Slowly, the place around the saplings becomes a meeting place for the villagers, and a small temple comes up there. I have seen one such temple and some 60-year-old neem and banyan trees in a village about 150 miles from Bangalore. I was lucky to find an old lady there, almost blind, who remembered the planting, the marriage, and how the rain god appeared in their village, bringing the much-needed water.
Let me add an amusing story. There is a village goddess by name Kabbalamma. Once she had an argument with her husband as to who is the superior of the two. So they take a bet that whoever goes to the market and buys all the essential things for the house without spending even a cent would win. And the winner has to pour burning coal over the loser's head. So first the husband goes to the market and comes back defeated, as he obviously cannot buy anything without spending money. Now comes the turn of our heroine. She creates a hurricane in the market, and the traders close their eyes to avoid dust. She picks up whatever she wants and comes home triumphantly. On a particular day of the summer months, strong winds blow over the village, and the goddess symbolizes the winds. As part of the event, burning coal is poured over her husband's image. This legend tells us how intelligent and quick-witted a goddess can be.
Just another shoplifter story? It goes to show that being so close to her devotees, the goddess naturally takes on their characteristics, including the very common husband and wife tiffs. Or maybe symbolic gestures are used to tell the story.
Hindu, I would like to say here that just like you or me or any woman, the moods of the goddesses are many. At times, she gets angry and furious and throws a tantrum if not appeased. She loves good clothes and gifts. At the same time, she's so down to earth and practical. She protects people, thus proving herself to be beneficial. She's loved by everybody, and in turn, she loves them, just like a caring mother.
I totally agree with you. Each symbolic gesture and each story about the Indian goddess is full of romance, courage, foresight, kindness, leadership, and so many other good qualities.
No wonder the village goddess has rulers, traders, farmers, and in fact, people from all sections of the society virtually falling at her feet, praising her and adoring her.
Does it mean that in India only village goddesses are worshipped?
No, there are many more sophisticated goddesses. We will talk about them in our next show. To end, thank you, Vatsala, for the painstaking research you have done. Gayatri and Aparna, thank you for your very good inputs. The recording for this show was done by M.R. Ramamurthy, and I am Indu Ramesh, signing off from Bangalore, India, for Wings.
Our email is wings@wings.org. Website, www.wings.org. The Wings Sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle Is Cast. Special thanks to Suzette Cullen and to Genevieve Vaughn, author of 36 Steps Toward a Gift Economy. This is the Women's International.